The following program is paid for by its sponsors, who are solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are not necessarily the views of WMAL.
When the time has come for moving on, you can't go wrong.
Pointing You Home with Eric Stewart on WMAL.
Pointing You Home.
Now, here's your host, Eric Stewart.
Good morning, Washington, and welcome to Pointing You Home. At the top of the 8 o'clock hour, you'll be hearing your number one resource for local real estate news. Pointing You Home with me, your host, Eric Stewart. At 8:30, our Senior Solutions show is back, talking all things aging well and more. And on today's show, I'm going to discuss how the real estate landscape of our metro area is changing and why that affects you and what makes a bedroom a legal bedroom. But first, did you know that Washington, D.C. is one of the most walkable metro areas in the nation? The D.C. area ranks second among 30 of the most walkable metropolitan areas in the United States. And one of the nation's most walkable places is literally right here in our own backyard. Since we are second among 30, the question mark that I would put at the end of every question is, how do you define this? Well, a walk-up or walk-up, which is George Washington University's Center for Real Estate and Urban Analysis, CREUA, has stated that New York City ranks first. Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, and Seattle complete the study's list of the highest-ranking walkable urban places, or walk-ups, those urban places that are walkable. But we're second. And they define this as the percentage of office, retail, and rental apartment space that's in a place, like DuPont Circle or Reston Town Center, where you can walk to get most of your daily needs met. And according to Professor Chris Leinberger, he's a GW University professor and chair of the CREUA, Leinberger said social equity is also factored into their rankings. Social equity. Interesting. We're not talking financial equity. We're talking social equity. This is a big driver. The social equity of a location. The ability to be socially available to seeing other people, being around other people, going to events where other people might be, going to restaurants where other people might be. That social equity is a huge driver, huge driver. It has been now for, I would say, maybe the last 10 to 15 years, especially noticeable here in Washington, D.C., as Washington, D.C. has gone through a massive regentrification, the development of D.C. into becoming a social equity area has been nothing short of amazing. If you look at downtown Arlington, if you look at downtown Bethesda, Chevy Chase, parts of Reston, et cetera, other areas, you look at the social equity that you get by living close to a downtown area. And what Liz Anderson with Planet Noun, who wrote an article in November that I'm speaking from, what she is suggesting that the George Washington University professor is suggesting is that social equity is factoring into why people are making a move to be close to Washington, D.C., and that makes it a walkable metro area, and it becomes one of the walk-ups, which again is defined as a walkable urban place. Even though housing in walkable urban areas tends to be more expensive than housing in drivable suburban areas, the study found that in walkable areas, low-income households spend a good deal less on transportation. And Leinberger noted that the reduced transportation costs offset the higher housing price tag, also saying that there's accessibility to more jobs in those spaces than there are out in the suburbs. Now look, the entire D.C. metro area was factored into this study, and the numbers show about 50% of the new development is going right into Washington, D.C. itself. But that does not mean that the burbs are going anywhere. The other 50% of the walkable urban development is going to the urbanizing suburbs. Arlington, downtown by Bethesda, like I said, Silver Spring is also a good example. So this is a strong motivator, not only for the millennials, which is what we have often heard about, but it's also been a big driver for the baby boomers. And tonight on Real Estate Now, I'll chat in greater detail about how the silent generation and the baby boomers are really driving the walkable communities, that it's just no longer just millennials that propel the interest in walkable communities. Perhaps you've wondered, what walkable communities might have to offer you. Maybe you'd like to see condominiums that would be walking distance to restaurants, a metro, and you thought, well, I've never really kind of taken that step, or I went out looking once, but it was very frustrating. I've got a fantastic buyer agent team here at the Eric Stewart Group. We literally have thousands of buyers in our database, literally thousands of buyers. And we have buyer agents who are working with the buyers and know exactly what these buyers want, feed information to those buyers on a daily basis in a very personal way to make sure that the buyers are on top of information about listings that are of value to them. Maybe you think, wow, that's amazing. You've got this wonderful staff. You've got a system in place. Well, what's amazing is how consistently the buyers that come to our group are finding what it is that they look for, and they're finding it sometimes in advance of it hitting the open market. When it comes to the open market, they're finding that our skill sets in negotiating are winning out against other buyers when there are 6, 7, 8, 9 offers, and you really want something because it's got a great southern view or whatever it might be that's important to you. So go to ericstewartgroup.com and reach out. We'll be glad to help you, or call us today if you'd prefer at 1-800-900-9104. Again, 800-900-9104. Let's jump in and chat about a contract that I was called on. A seller was referred to me by her friend who listens to the show. The seller had gone to contract on the sale of her property, and she had changed her mind after going under contract. Just a few days later, she decided that where she had moved to at this point was really not making her happy, and she wanted to know if she could get out of the contract to sell her property. So I said to her, look, I'm not an attorney, and if you're under contract, your title to the property has transferred at the point of ratification, subject to the buyer fulfilling the terms of your agreement, coming to settlement with the funds, getting their loan, going through a home inspection, whatever the terms might have been in that offer. And she said, I know, but I'm not looking for legal advice. I just want to know what the options are. And I said, well, your options here are really few because you're not in a controlling position in the contract. The buyer is in a controlling position. They're able to declare the contract null and void if they want on the home inspection. And there are no homeowners association documents for the buyer to review for this seller's property. So the seller also has one less contingency that the buyer could walk away from. If the buyer doesn't get financing, then the seller can declare the contract null and void. I said, really, if you are absolutely sure that you don't want to sell your property, are you going to move back into it? And she said, yes. And I said, and your husband, he'll move back with me. Does he want to move back with you? No, but he'll move back with me. So why is it that you don't want to move? Because I'm not happy here. I moved out of my house. I vacated it. I put it on the market. Then I moved into a different place. And I did all of this very, very quickly. And after just a short period of time, I realized I'm not happy where I'm at, and I want to go back to the house I love. So I said, well, you're going to have a home inspection? And she said, yes. And I said, well, the buyers are going to probably ask you for some things to fix. You could be very obstinate and difficult in that if you really are committed to it. She said, okay. I said, but you're going to need to read your contract, and you should talk with your broker to get specific advice on what you want to do. She said, okay. And I said, is it worth $5,000 for you to get out of this contract? And she said, yes. I said, is it worth $10,000? She said, no. And I said, okay, well, there's another option for you. Maybe you want to buy out the contract and offer some cash to the buyer to let you out. But she has another dilemma, which I didn't mention to her because I didn't think of it until after we got off the phone. And that is that she would be obligated to pay the commission to both of the brokers, because the brokers will have completed their work by selling the property and taking it to contract if she just terminates it and gets a release on it. Because the listing broker did his or her job in selling the property, and the buyer broker did their job in bringing the contract to settlement. So to breach the contract, she would still have to pay the brokers for their time, assuming that they wouldn't let her off without paying. So her property was around $400,000, and so she'd have quite a bit of commission and possibly a fee to pay to the buyer to get out. Now, hopefully she'll work that detail out. There are very few times as a seller where you can get out of a contract, but I've seen it happen. I've had buyers come in and try to ask for the moon on a home inspection, and my sellers say to me after we're already up for sale, "Hey, I've decided I really don't want to sell my house. I've got cold feet. What do I do?" And I said, just be difficult if you want to get out, and it'll be up to the buyer to take offense and walk away. And sure enough, if you make it really hard for that buyer, if you talk to that buyer through your contract by rejecting, just crossing through with big, bold lines, sending it back, writing rejected on the piece of paper, the buyer will look at that and go, "What? This is a completely unreasonable seller." Now, you know, it's up to the buyer to catch wind of what you're trying to do. You know, sometimes a buyer really wants to buy the house but thinks they can negotiate. And then when they realize that they can't negotiate, it sometimes is too late. See, in the home inspection, at least in the state of Maryland, the seller of a property has to accept whatever the requests are from a buyer on the home inspection, request the list. They have to accept that list, accept the inspection, read it over, and then they can reject it. Now, if the buyer comes back and renegotiates, the seller can then declare the contract null and void, but not so fast. The buyer still has the option of coming back within 3 days and either accepting what the seller had previously agreed to, which was that they would do nothing, or the contract will die, and then the seller's home free and can keep their house. The contract is so important. And if you're listening to the show, you think, gosh, you know a lot about contracts. Folks, every show, I'm going to bring you insight into what I'm experiencing in my real estate practice so that you can become more informed as a consumer. What makes a bedroom legal? Right after this.
This is Pointing You Home, FM and AM 630.
One of the most read articles on my website is an article I wrote in June of 2015. It's titled, "What Makes a Bedroom a Legal Bedroom?" See, defining a legal bedroom might seem simple, but despite clear building codes, the process is wrought with gray areas. Building inspectors, appraisers, real estate agents, and potential buyers may have differing opinions and perspectives that affect the definition of a bedroom. Before discussing any disparities, however, here are the types of requirements covered by the International Residential Code, also known as the IRC, and used in defining a legal bedroom in the D.C. metropolitan area. The minimum ceiling height, room width, and floor area square footage. The floor area square footage. So you have to have a specific height, width, and floor area. The private accessibility considerations. The lighting and ventilation specifications. Minimum stipulations for a window to qualify as an emergency egress. And also the number of electric outlets. Minimum of 2. Okay, so space, first of all. I've been out showing real estate in Kensington, Maryland, and also in Arlington. In 1950s, brick and block ramblers, split levels, split foyers, and oftentimes there's a bedroom in the basement of a home. And the bedroom has a window, the bedroom has a closet, but the ceiling height is quite low. Maybe it's only 6.5 feet in height. Maybe you have a room like that as well. Now, mind you, you may have lived in your home for many years, and that might, in fact, be a bedroom for one of your family members. It might be a bedroom that you used to use as a bedroom, and you still think of it as a bedroom. But under the IRC guidelines, the ceiling height must be a minimum of 7 feet. Now, I'll say that 99.99% of real estate agents do not know what I'm telling you. They do not know that there's a minimum ceiling height. They'll walk into a room, and as long as there's a window that's big enough for someone to get out of and a door to get out of in case of a fire, they think, I've got a bedroom. They might even assume that it needs to have a closet. In terms of space, if it doesn't have 7 feet of ceiling height and I'm representing a buyer, I'm in kind of a good position to negotiate with that agent. Because I can bring to that agent the knowledge that I'm bringing to you now and point out to them that their ceiling height of that basement room is not tall enough to call it a bedroom, though that agent may be advertising it that way. So mind you, a buyer agent may be more aware than a listing agent what the rules are with respect to the ceiling height and could use that to negotiate favorably. The ceiling height must be 7 feet. It has to be a minimum of 7 feet in either direction. The width and the length of the room must be 7. So you have to have also a minimum of 70 square feet of floor area. So if you have 7 feet of width and 7 feet of depth and 7 feet of height, you don't have the minimum square feet of floor area. You can have it be 7 feet wide and 10 feet long, or 7 feet long and 10 feet wide, and then you have 7 times 10 or 70 square feet of floor area, and a ceiling that's at least 7 feet above the ground. One creative way to raise the ceiling in the bedroom to the minimum of 7 feet is actually remove the drop ceiling. By removing the drop ceiling, you then got that extra inch or two or three or four, which will help you get to 7 feet. I did something interesting in my house. I actually lowered the floor in my basement. And I did that because the basement had been poured to the top of the footers at the time of construction in 1968. I moved into my childhood home and then did a renovation to it. And we were able to lower the floor by 8 inches from the top of the footer to the bottom of the footer and be in compliance with the current building code guidelines, which required that the basement be poured to the bottom of the footers versus the top, as it had been, I guess, previously. So we got an extra 8 inches that way, which gave us a tremendous benefit in headroom. A lot of extra work, no doubt, but you could do that as well. You have to have 7 feet in height. You have to have at least 70 square feet of floor area. Now, as far as access, single entry room in Maryland, Virginia, or D.C., in order for it to count as a bedroom, it must be accessible without passing through another bedroom. And this also ensures that each bedroom has access to a bathroom without having to go through another bedroom. For those of you who have added a bedroom where you actually go through a room to get to another room, it's not legally another bedroom, even if you used it that way personally, right? The way you used it is the way you used it, but the way you advertise it has to be in compliance with what the rules are. As far as lighting and ventilation, many individuals currently sleep in rooms such as dens or sitting rooms that may not count as a legal bedroom according to the IRC. These regulations are intended to help keep the sleeper safe by ensuring that the occupant has adequate lighting and ventilation proportional to the room's size. For lighting purposes, a window's viewing size must be proportional to 8% of the room's floor area, with an opening no less than 4% of the room's floor area for proper ventilation. So think of that. You've got to have the ability for air to move in and out of that room, and it has to have an opening in the room of at least 4% of the room floor's area for it to be considered proper ventilation. That could be a ductwork on one side. You could actually put a vent in a door to the hall outside to provide an additional amount of that ventilation. Either or both requirements might be reduced or waived if sufficient artificial light sources and mechanical ventilation are supplied, including, you know, proper ducting in and the blowing of air into that space. Windows. This is kind of the big deal breaker here, because windows are still required in single entry rooms. However, to serve as an emergency egress, you must actually have one that's 24 inches high by 20 inches wide with a minimum of 5.7 square feet of opening. That's the width and the height. It can be no more than 44 inches above the bedroom floor. All right, so that safety mechanism in case of a fire in a basement allows an inhabitant to be able to climb out of that window and climb up. Now, if you're below grade, outside the window, you have to have a window well that has a ladder to climb out of it. You must be very observant of this. Now, you'll notice that I haven't mentioned anything about a closet. There really are no legal requirements that a bedroom must have a closet. Rooms without closets may not be a deal breaker to buyers, especially if they are looking at similar older homes in an area that were not built with closets. However, some appraisers might require a framed-in closet or permanently install an armoire to count the space as a bedroom within the house, so you'll have to take that into account when the appraisal is completed. Oh, almost forgot. If you've got a room that's a den and you're using it like a bedroom, be careful. You cannot necessarily assume that an appraiser will see it the same way, so be wary of that. Hey, we bring in the truth in real estate. It's consumer-oriented real estate information, buying and selling, everything in between, here on Pointing You Home every Sunday morning from 8 to 8:30. It's always my pleasure to be with you. Senior Solutions, straight ahead. I'm Eric Stewart. See you then.
Pointing You Home with Eric Stewart on 105.9 FM and AM 630 WMAL.